But I do, Jeff and Nikki, thank you for filling in this weekend. We really do appreciate it. All of our other worship teams were not available, so we appreciate you filling in that way and energizing us this morning with what with your heart and your passion. So I'm continuing on in this series, Angels, Demons, and You. For a number of weeks, I spent some time talking about how there were guardian angels and that God assigns angels to us here in this world, and that they probably are around more than what you might think they are, and that they play a vital role in our protection and our flourishing as believers. And then I spent a few weeks talking about the presence of, you know, demonic activity in our lives, that that there are things called demons, and they work for Satan, and they do try to influence our lives in really, really destructive ways. They have a mandate, and that is our destruction. And so we probably don't appreciate on either side of things how much guardian angels participate in our life, and then how much there are the presence of demons and their activity in our lives and what they try to do to us. And we're so thankful that God in his common grace protects us from demonic influences. So today I'm going to be talking about Satan, and I've never really preached on Satan for any length of time at all. I don't know why I haven't, but I haven't. It's interesting to me. You sort of feel like the Wizard of Oz a little bit when you pull back the curtain. When you pull back the curtain of who Satan is, you realize that he's not what you think he is in many ways. And then in other ways, he's much more than what you thought he was. And to be misinformed on either end of those things too much opens us up in ways that we shouldn't be opened up. It makes us really vulnerable. And so, as I talk about this today, I want you to know that in some ways, some of what I'm going to be sharing with you today and probably next Sunday, because I have a lot here, I don't think I can get through all of it. It's hard won. In other words, I'll say this, that, and I was thinking about this as I was driving in here this morning. It seems to me, I mean, you would think, wouldn't you, that the more sanctified you become, the more mature as a believer you are, perhaps even the more Christ-like you try to become and are, you would think that that would diminish temptation. But it really doesn't. It just changes the kind of temptation that you get. So, for example, if you have grown in your faith a great deal and you become a threat to much of what Satan would like to achieve, do you think he's just going to stand idly by while you do that? Or do you think he's going to try and come up with new ways in which he can tempt you in order to destroy not only you, but the good work that you're trying to do on behalf of Christ? So if any of us are confused about why is it that we don't seem to have less temptation in some ways than what we had before, I would say to you that temptation oftentimes is a different kind of temptation because your maturity warrants it. So he just goes to a new method, a new strategy, than what he had before. And so I think it's important for all of us to be aware that that is, in some ways, how Satan is more than what you think he is. More than what you think he is. So again, as I was thinking about, you know, what I was going to share with you, and my mind came to a person who's named Blaise Pascal. Now, Blaise Pascal was a French mathematician, a physicist, an inventor, a philosopher, a mystic, and a Catholic writer who lived in the 17th century. He's actually, in many respects, one of my more favorite people that I like to quote. Blaise Pascal let me see if I have my notes here. I'm sorry, I don't normally fumble like this, but I just wanted to, I'm getting a little ahead of myself in a good way, and, so I'll get to it. So Blaise Pascal, and so this is the reason why I wanted to bring this up. Even in a room like this, even among people like this, and I didn't know who was going to be here this morning, but if you were to go to most seminaries in the country today, most well-established seminaries in the country today, most of them would say that they believe that God exists in some way. Most of them would equally say that Satan is a myth, that he doesn't really exist, and it's just a construct of ours to create fear, to keep people in line, that, you know, it's kind of a primitive thing, that it's not really sophisticated. I mean, there are all kinds of arguments for it, but those are the kinds of things that they would say. And so around the late 17th century, early 18th century, was what we call the rise of the Enlightenment. And so people began to doubt certain things about Christianity, about God, and things like that. And Blaise Pascal came up with this thing called the wager. And I've mentioned it to you before, and I'm bringing it up because I want you to understand that I do believe that Satan exists, and I do believe he's very much at work in the world in which we live, and I do believe that he's very much in charge of a group of people, a group of beings that who are devoted to our destruction. And that may not sound very very sophisticated or very intellectual or whatever, but maybe that's just where Satan wants us to be. That if we deny his existence, then that gives him more in the way of free reign than what he would have otherwise, right? But in any case, he wrote this thing called The Wager. And here is Blaise Pascal's wager explained. The argument considers two possibilities. Either God exists or God does not exist. And the choices are that an individual can choose to believe in God or not believe. So either God exists or he doesn't exist. You can either choose to believe that he exists, or you can choose to believe that he doesn't exist. Now, Blaise goes on to say that the outcomes are, if God exists and you believe, you gain everything, infinite happiness. Can you hit that one? Yeah, thank you. If God exists and you believe, you gain everything, infinite happiness. And if God exists and you don't believe, you lose everything, infinite suffering and or hell. Those are the choices. That's how it works out. Or, he goes on to say, God doesn't exist and you believe. You lose a finite amount of your life, for example, worldly pleasures by following religious rules. Or, God doesn't exist and you don't believe and you gain a finite amount of life free from religious constraints, etc. The point that Blaise is trying to say is that even if you don't believe, your life will be better. Because you'll just live, qualitatively, you'll live a better life. If you don't believe, then you probably won't live qualitatively a better life. Now, it seems to me that as he talked about how if God exists, if God does exist, then what does that mean for me in the sense of what does that mean for me in terms of how I believe other things? So for example, if God exists and he says that Satan exists, then it's almost just as important for me to believe that Satan exists than it would if God exists, right? So for those seminaries and those professors out there that want to say that they believe that God exists, but they don't want to believe what God says exists, then they aren't helping things very much. They're misguiding people, and they're placing them in danger. Now, one of the things that, and Blaise Pascal, who was very passionate about his faith, had an experience, November 23rd, 1654, and this is what I was looking for a little earlier, and he called it the Night of Fire. Now, he took a piece of paper and he wrote down, "Fire, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, not of the philosophers and scholars. Certitude, heartfelt joy, peace, God of Jesus Christ, God of Jesus Christ, joy, 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 tears of joy, Jesus Christ, may I never be separated from him." So in that experience, and some people might say that that might have been his conversion experience, or that might have been in the fundamentalist tradition, we might have called that a crisis experience, but he took these words and he wrote them on that parchment right there. And he took that parchment that you see right there, that's a copy of it, and he folded it up, and he had it sewn into his overcoat. And back then, everybody wore an overcoat. Didn't matter what time of the year it was. You never went outside without an overcoat. And he had that sewn in his overcoat, these words, in his overcoat, placed over his heart. And when he died, as people were going through his possessions, they felt an awkwardness in his overcoat. It just felt strange. They could see where something had been sewn inside, and they pulled out this that was resting over his heart the whole of his life that he wore that overcoat and had that experience. And for Blaise Pascal, that was his way of protecting himself against Satan and his designs upon his life. Those words on his heart in that way. It was kind of like a phylactery, a Jewish phylactery, if you know what that is. But it was kind of like that. But Blaise understood in his faith that there were certain things that were important for him to do, certain extraordinary steps to help protect himself from the influence of the enemy. And he remembered that night of fire, where he had this encounter with God that was so profound and so powerful, and I will read it to you again. "Fire, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, not of the philosophers and the scholars. Certitude, heartfelt joy, peace, God of Jesus Christ, God of Christ, joy, 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 tears of joy. Jesus Christ, may I never be separated from him." And he wanted to do this in terms of what he did with this document in his overcoat to help keep the influence of the enemy from him losing any of this. So if God exists and God says that Satan exists, then given that God cannot lie, Satan must exist. And if he does exist, the implications for us are enormous. So today then, I'm going to be talking about who is Satan and what are his roles in our life. So this is who Satan is in short. He is a created spiritual being of great intellect and power. Allegedly, second only in ability to that of the Godhead. But unlike the Godhead, Satan does not have omnipotence, that is, that say he's not all-powerful. Omniscience, he is not all-knowing. And omnipresence, he cannot be everywhere at one time like God can. He is, however, the most complete personification of evil and rebelliously opposes God and all that is loved by God, striving to destroy God's creation by using temptation and deception. So we have this formidable foe that is opposed to us. And part of his opposition is to frustrate God, to have God lose what he loves. And we are, in one sense, a pawn in his plan to be rebellious to God in that way. So who was Satan, and what is he now? So Jonathan Edwards, who was one of the great Puritan preachers in the United States from New England, probably one of the more influential preachers in the history of our country, Jonathan Edwards wrote this about who Satan was. So, writing extensively on fallen angels, Jonathan Edwards believed that Lucifer, the name that many in the church history have given to Satan before his fall, was created to be immensely superior to all the other angels and held a type of leadership, dominion, and strength over the other angels. Edwards goes on to say, Lucifer, before his fall, Edwards writes, was the chief of all the angels, of the greatest natural capacity, who had strength and wisdom, and highest in honor and dignity, the brightest of all those stars. And he cites Isaiah 14:12, where Isaiah says, how you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of the dawn, as an indication that Lucifer outshined all the other angels that were created. Edwards believed the title of the anointed cherub from Ezekiel 28:14 points to the fact that Lucifer was created as the highest of all angels. Lucifer is also described in Ezekiel 28:14 as residing on the holy mountain of God, who walked in the midst of the stones of fire. In Ezekiel 28:16, there seems to be a reference to the covering cherub, who resides in the temple's holy of holies, who uses his wings to cover the throne of God. In this context, Edwards believes this cherub to be the being who was in the closest proximity to the throne of God. Edwards notes that this was a great honor and caused him to be exalted above all the other angels. Yet Edwards quickly pointed out, as a second person of the Godhead, Christ is exalted supremely higher than Lucifer. So it's important to note that when you talk about Lucifer or Satan, that the person opposite of Lucifer is not Jesus. The person opposite of Lucifer would be Michael or Gabriel. Sometimes people make those two equal, and they are not. Jesus is supremely higher than what Satan is. But Satan was higher, apparently, according to these texts, says Edwards, than all of the other angels. So in other words, Edwards speculated that while Lucifer was only near the throne, Christ, being supremely higher and more excellent in his being, sat down forever with God on the throne. So this is who we believe, at least that's whom Edwards believes Satan to be. So this conclusion results in Edwards' astonishing statement. He says, Lucifer, in having the excellency of those glorious things that were about him, all summed up in him, he was a type of Christ in whom all the glory and excellency of all elect creatures is more promptly summed up as the head and fountain of all, as the brightness of all that reflects the light of the sun and is summed up in the sun. This archangel was assigned to cover or to protect the beloved race, mankind, that was God's jewel, his treasure, his first fruits, his precious thing laid up in God's ark or chest or cabinet, hid in the secret of God's presence. In other words, Lucifer, according to Edwards, was employed at the creation of man to be the protector of redeemed humanity, but he fell from his innocency and dignity, and Jesus, in his stead, becomes the cherub that covereth the great protector. So, I know I read a lot to you, and I know that it was fairly dense. But it is true, and I think that Lewis is true when he says this, that anything that has within it the potential or the ability for a tremendous amount of good equally has within it the tremendous potential for a tremendous amount of bad. Because anything that is bad is a corrupt goodness. So if something has a great possibility for goodness and it's corrupted, it now has a great possibility for badness. Lucifer, or Satan, had a tremendous possibility for goodness and had goodness, but it became corrupted. And that's why now he has tremendous capacity for badness, because his goodness, his potential, his strength was corrupted. And it was tragic. So here are some different names for Satan and what they tell us about his nature and his activity. There is a name Lucifer, which was his name before he fell. The name Lucifer means light bringer or morning star. I know that we use that synonymously with Satan, but those two words do not mean the same thing. So this was his name before he fell, Lucifer, which means light bringer or morning star. We are all familiar with the word Beelzebub, which often translated as Lord of the Flies, probably indicating death, rotting, corruption. The devil, a generic term for the evil spirit or fallen angel. The dragon, a title referring to his great and monstrous power. You'll read about that particularly in the book of Revelation. The serpent, or the serpent of old, a reference to the Garden of Eden. And so, in many respects, he had kind of like the attributes of what many people think of when they think of a serpent, is kind of like slimy and sneaky and slithery and gross and those kinds of things. The accuser, or adversary, who opposes God and his people. The tempter, referring to his role in tempting people. The deceiver, also known as the father of lies, that have to do with descriptions of his deceptive nature. The Antichrist, a figure who is the opposite of Christ in his nature. Belial, a name associated with lawlessness and wickedness. And then Abaddon, or Apollyon, a Greek and Hebrew names for the destroyer, or the angel of the abyss. So these are the names of Satan, as you would read throughout Scripture. These names are often what are used for him. And so you can learn a lot about who he is just by the names that he has, the different kinds of pseudonyms that have been given to him throughout Scripture. So what are the roles of Satan as related to humanity? What are their roles? What kind of role does he play? The first one is Satan the tempter. So this is no surprise to us here. as we see Satan as the tempter, He is a person who moves into our life and gets us to do things that maybe we wouldn't do otherwise. So all temptation, in many respects, is predicated on desire. Certain desires that we have. We may have a desire to be famous. We may have a desire to be respected. We may have sexual desire. We may have a desire to be attractive, overtly so. We may have a desire to be wealthy. And Satan has a way of taking those hidden desires, or maybe not so hidden desires, and tempting us in a way that corrupts us as we try to gain the things that we desire. So Adam and Eve, for example, Eve desired to be like God. So she ate of the fruit, and then she gave the fruit to Adam, and he ate of the fruit. And as a result of that, they fell, and all of mankind with them. If you want to know why you are being tempted in certain ways, then it would be really helpful if you were able to identify the desire that was associated with that. So there are some people, for example, who have to control everything. Just really important. Their desire is to control everything. Well, the temptation is to control everything, but the hidden desire is for power or for influence or for security. They are afraid. And because they're afraid, they want to control things so that they get exactly the outcome that they want, because that's what will give them security. There are some people who have had, and this isn't everybody, but many or most, who have anger problems. You think, well, what would be the desire for that? Well, the desire would be to get what you want. That either something happened that you don't think should have happened, something's wrong that you think shouldn't be wrong, but the desire is to get the outcome that you want. And so either we use our anger or allow our anger to be used in such a way to intimidate people to get them to do what it is that we want them to do. I mean, it's endless. If you want to know how Satan is going to tempt you, understand the desires that you have in your heart. Because if those desires remain unidentified, then he will always be able to have control over you in some way. Those desires are hidden buttons that he can push. And when he pushes those buttons, you begin to react in ways. I can't begin to tell you how many people I've talked with over the course of my life who would say to me when they succumb to some kind of temptation, I don't know where that came from. That's not who I am. And of course, I would respond to them in a very pastorly fashion. It's exactly who you are. It's not all that you are. We are our sin, but our one sin is not all that we are. But usually when they give in to that particular kind of sin, it's because of some kind of desire that they have that either hasn't been identified or hasn't been respected or hasn't been addressed. And so Satan has the ability to push certain buttons in that area of desire to get us to do things that we might not do otherwise. Satan as our adversary. And by the way, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians, no temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. So Paul is not saying, like, when you become a Christian, you will never be tempted again. He's not saying that. He's saying that all believers will still continue to be tempted again. I mean, really, if we were to take, just since you've gotten up this morning, if we were to take all of the temptations that we've had this morning, things that we thought or maybe things that we did, and we were to list them, if they were this rolling screen on the TV for all of us that came up here, what would that look like? Yeah, it would be embarrassing for all of us, right? I mean, we would not look like a very holy church if all those temptations began to screen or roll down this screen above me. But we all struggle with temptation. And so the Apostle Paul is assuring us, look, you're going to be tempted. And, you know, as you mature in your faith, you're going to be tempted differently than how you were tempted before. But don't be hopeless about it. That he will provide a way out. And aren't we all very thankful that God is merciful and gracious when we succumb to our temptation? And we learn from it, hopefully, and we move on. Number two, Satan is our adversary. Now, the word Satan literally means adversary, or the one who opposes. So when he is called Satan, he is aptly named. He is what he is named. He is what he is named. He is our adversary. He is an adversary, and really you cannot overemphasize this too much. He is an adversary that wants very, 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 very much for everyone in here to be destroyed. And if there's a lot of pain and suffering with it, so much the better. So the Apostle Peter tells us, be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. So we're all in the same boat together, right? Now, what's interesting in this text from 1 Peter chapter 4 says, and I would tell you that the exact, but my, for some reason, my, when we sent this as a file to be printed, it dropped off the 1 Peter 4 and then whatever verse it is, but it's in 1 Peter chapter 4. But in any case, the word adversary, the Greek word adversary in 1 Peter 1, there we go, I'm sorry, chapter 5, verse 8, is the Greek word antidikos. This word antidikos is a legal term for an opponent in a lawsuit or a prosecuting attorney. This term applies that the devil acts as an accuser, bringing charges against believers in a spiritual courtroom by highlighting their past sins to cause them to feel unworthy and to be devoured. So when it says, be sober-minded and watchful, your adversary, the prosecutor, it's like this prosecutor who goes around town looking for people who are just breaking the law. And as soon as they see someone who broke the law, then they throw the book at them. They arrest them, and they hold them to account, and they do everything they can to bring them to judgment. So Satan is like this aggressive, powerful, scary, roaring lion who goes about in our lives as the prosecutor to find every sin for which you and I should be judged. And to make the argument before God why we should not receive his grace. That's exactly what's going on here in this text. All of us here, when we were young, or in our workplace, have had enemies. People who would say things about you that were unjust or unfair. They would undermine your work, your character, your credibility, your reputation. And sometimes it's just very frustrating to have these people in your life. They're your enemy. They're your sworn enemy. They don't care what happens to you in terms of anything good. We've all had people like that in our life. You have the second most powerful being, aside from the Godhead, in your life, trying to find every sin that you've ever committed and to bring that in a prosecutorial way to God the Father to tell him why you should not be blessed and be saved. And some of us help him. We give him a lot of ammo, right? And so that's why, I mean, that's not why, but that's helpful for us to understand about why we should work hard in our own faith and our own spirituality. So this is who Satan is, as our adversary. He is our enemy. It's interesting to me how in pop culture, in many of the TV programs and movies and things like that, how, you know, many of them are being written and directed so that, you know, Satan is sort of, they kind of make the argument that Satan has been unjustly described. You know, he's got a bad rap. He's not really that bad. There's more of that out there than what you would think. So Satan is a liar and deceiver. And I just want to say this about, before we get to the third one, Satan is a liar. And then number four, Satan is a deceiver. I wanted to explain this to you, the difference between lying and deception. Lying, so Satan is known as a liar, and Satan is also known as a deceiver. Lying is the act of making a false statement with the intent to deceive. While deception is the broader concept of leading someone to believe something untrue, which can be achieved through lies, omissions, exaggerations, or actions. The key difference is that all lies are forms of deception, but not all deceptions are lies. For example, a lie directly communicates a falsehood, whereas other forms of deception might involve carefully omitting information or presenting misleading evidence to create a false impression. Now, it's important to understand this, that when it comes to lying and when it comes to deception, it erodes truth and trust. When somebody lies to you or when someone deceives you, you believe that you can't trust them. So Satan cannot be trusted in any way because he is a liar and a deceiver from the very beginning. Even though he appears as an angel of light sometimes, he deceives us as an angel of light. So even though when we're trying to rationalize our way through something, should we do this? Should we not? Should we think this way? Should we not? And Satan presents the way that he wants us to go as an enlightened rationalization. That it's really good. Look, it's the examples in our culture are endless about all of the destructive ways in which people live their lives. But many within that same culture will argue how it's an enlightened way to live. It's a healthy way to live. It's a good way to live. And probably the most poignant example is the whole transgender thing. Since the beginning of time that we were ever doing psychoanalysis, we've understood transgenderism as being body dysmorphia. The people were mentally unhealthy about how they saw their body. But now the argument is, this is healthy. This is good. They're just on a different part of the spectrum. And it's a part of the deception and part of the lie that Satan makes on behalf of himself for humanity. So Satan as a liar. Number three. Jesus said to the Jewish religious leaders in John, he said, "You are of your father, the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his own character, for he is a liar and the father of lies." When we look at the temptation of Christ, what Satan tried to do with Jesus when he was in the wilderness for 40 days to be tempted by Satan, they were all of those conversations that Satan had with Jesus were an assortment of lies and deceptions. The changing of the stones into bread was predicated on a lie and deception. To throw himself down from the temple was predicated on lies and deception. Mountains and the kingdom of being on top of the mountain and seeing the kingdoms of the world was based on lies and deception. So number four, Satan as the deceiver. Remember, lies are different than deception. And so we read in Revelation 12:9, "And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him." The deceiver of the whole world. Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 4:4, "The god of this world, that is Satan, has blinded the minds of the unbelievers, to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God." People who aren't receptive to the gospel or to Christ or to God, their minds have been blinded. They have been deceived about what really is and what is not. So how does Satan deceive? He hides the truth from people. He can appear as an angel of light, and he can lie. And most of us in this room on some level are living in some deception that he has for us in our life. There's some deception that he is at work with in our life on some level for everyone in this room. There's some deceptive strategy at play in your life right now, even as I am telling you. So you pray for wisdom. You pray for the Holy Spirit to show you. You have the courage to face it. And then you do what you need to do in order to overcome it in that way. Now, here's what I'm going to do, and I think maybe next week I might pick this up again. But I want you to understand this, that there is a progression here. The progression is this, that Satan is a fallen angel. Number one. Number two, that he uses temptation to try and destroy us, predicated on our desires. That as a tempter, Satan is our adversary. He wants to destroy us. Number four and five, that he uses lies and deception as our adversary to destroy us. That when he does that and we stand before God, before the judgment throne, Satan becomes our accuser. Now get this. Satan does everything he can to destroy us and to get us to do things that are contrary to God. He does it. He and his demons work in our lives to do that. And then if someone dies, not having come to Christ, if someone dies and stands before the judgment throne, Satan, who created that person, says, "Look what they did. Look at all the sin in their life. You can't let them into heaven. They were covetous. They were lusty. They were liars. They were murderers. They did all these things." He created that person. Then he accuses that person. And then when he does that, and that person enters into hell but not heaven, when he does that, Satan becomes a murderer. When Jesus said that Satan was a liar and a murderer from the very beginning, the murder part is the people that he created through lies and temptation and deception, those people, when they die, when they are cast into the fiery lake, when they die, he murdered them. And he wants to murder you and me too. But thanks be to God, that doesn't have to be our life. Romans 10:13 says, "For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved." I want to say, and I don't want to overly spiritualize this, my notes are a mess. They weren't a mess when I sent them, but they're a mess here. I'm trying to pull back the curtain. And I just wonder why my notes are a mess. Again, I'm not trying to overly spiritual. I'm sitting here. I'm standing here. If I took you to my original files at home and you saw them on my computer, they do not look like this. So I'm having to cut and paste while I'm standing here speaking to you. I asked Mike when I said there were some pages missing, and I asked Mike about it. He said, "That's all there were." That is not what is on my computer at home. So, all that to say, he is not what many of us think he is. He's not some cute little guy running around in a red pajama suit with a couple horns on his head and, you know, some kind of a weird tail. Or that's cloven hooves. That's just not who he is. And he is much more insidious, much more hateful, much more determined, much more resourceful, much more intelligent. He knows he's going to die, but he also is committed to taking as many people with him as he possibly can. People like you and me, people that you know and love, people that need you to be involved in their life. You need to be their angel of sorts.